Welcome to Counterpoint. I'm Jonathan Judakin. With me today is renowned conceptual artist Mel Chin. In the catalog to the show Rematch, a retrospective on his work, Miranda Lash writes, Mel Chin has been labeled a conceptual artist not only because the primacy of ideas in his work, but also as a means of explaining the diversity of his practice. Since the mid-1970s, he's explored making art in a broad spectrum of media, including sculpture, painting, drawing, video, film, video games, performance, and the development of scientific protocols. On February 18th at 6 p.m. at Rhodes College, Mel Chin will give the keynote lecture for the symposium, Memphis Art and Place, which will begin a set of discussions around Memphis about art and social change. I'm looking forward to getting this dialogue going with Mel Chin. Welcome to Counterpoint.
Hi.
Mel, a lot of people listening have seen conceptual art or they've experienced conceptual art, but they don't necessarily connect it with that term. I know conceptual art is all about highlighting what's wrong with labels like conceptual art, but what does it mean to you that this label has been often fixed to your name as an artist?
I resemble that remark, but I guess the word conceptual art, there was a movement at one time that maybe brought some feelings about what it means as I sit around and think of things and, hey, that's good enough. But maybe the way I define it for myself is that there's hardly anything that I involve in my practice in that isn't starting with a concept that drives it. So maybe we go that way. Therefore, it is not just a concept that I will type out and present as the work. Like, this is the concept, that's good enough. Which I think is good enough, by the way. Historically, that's pretty groovy too. But I think concept is what drives any one of those many things that Miranda has graciously annotated as my practice.
So what are some of the ways in which conceptual art, I guess, goes beyond the traditional aspects of visual art, sculpture, and painting? Can you talk a little bit more about that and why you think that it arose as a movement in art?
There was a great division. If we want to go into art history, you can look at two giants. They were small men, I believe, but like Picasso or Marcel Duchamp. And the idea of art as being something that you just look at and you observe, but you bring yourself into it, is a more retinal approach of understanding, which is quite adequate and quite powerful in its capacity. And then the idea of something that is non-retinal, but conceptual or coming from a more cerebral place as its point of origin means that it can definitely have the retinal quality to it. It can have a look, it can have something, but that's not where its origin is. Now, you can check out some expert in the art historical process and you'll find quite adequate descriptions of the practice. Now, the way I do it, I feel that, again, whether it's a political event or observation, the way I work is it comes first, it's seeded by a concept. And then if it has to be the film or it has to be the object, that will be the way it materializes.
Mel, I've seen you called an Asian Texan, which in and of itself is an interesting concept. It's a formulation I just love. You were born in Houston to Chinese parents. You're raised in an African-American and Latino neighborhood. You attended college in Tennessee at Peabody in Nashville. I want to ask you about these art pieces you made while you were at Peabody titled Western Dynasty Urns. These urns apparently drew on ancient Asian techniques of pottery, but you made them with Texan longhorns. And you suggested these works of pottery should be buried under the foundation of the Contemporary Arts Museum in Houston so that maybe in some future archaeologists might discover them and come to understand that Chinese immigrants might be regarded as the true forebears of Texas. I don't know if I'm getting the whole story right, but can you tell us a little bit about these early pieces of yours, Western Dynasty urns?
I was going to college, obviously, and made a promise to myself that I would be more of a student because I thought that was my job there. And so that freed me to go everywhere within my mind and the libraries and all. One thing that I did not want to involve myself with, because all the study, the student work, would lead me to become this great artist someday. That was my delusion and remains that to be my delusion. that I wouldn't touch this craft stuff. I was way above it. Then I had to take a mandatory class, and my life was transformed. I felt it was something I could not do. I was proven I couldn't accomplish it very easily. I was quite facile at both all the other forms. And maybe that is what drove me to try to understand it. And that drove me into the research of the whole historical processes of ceramics from all cultures. And it led me even to the world of conceptual art through a friend of Marcel Duchamp's, Betty Woodman, I believe, who was an artist. And all these things emerged, and everything came together through this obsession. It also made me develop my own appreciation for my own roots or my ruts. Yes, growing up in Texas can leave you somewhat absent from Chinese culture if you're the only family in a neighborhood called the Fifth Ward. That could limit some work. It also can limit yourself even if you finally go to high school in Bel Air, which was called Hebrew High, which gave me another Melchinsky attitude toward life. But at that time, looking at clay and all its permutations and all its ability to impart something of the human imagination became compelling. I became so much involved with it that I became a cycle ceramicist. You know, I even quit making paintings and sculpture, became a janitor to the pottery shop, which is an impossible job, by the way, just so I could be there 24/7. I became obsessed with clay and all of what it meant and all that it could convey. So learning to do those urns, I was studying the Song Dynasty forms. It's about forms, of course, and that is definitely within the retinal field, making a form and making it match or making it work from an aesthetic point of view was essential so it could impart something. But rather than just replicating the Song Dynasty form, I began to skin it with this idea, what if a whole nother culture were to take this over or be part of it? So that work was intended actually to use the imagination and the research to create a whole dynastic tradition. And then this whole evolution from the earliest forms of clay to almost a Neolithic form to a refined, maybe Song Dynasty 10th century form. But with those Western motifs, just throwing that in there for humor's sake as well, but to lay it in the ground and then to do it in secret, bury it, stage a performance archaeological dig to uncover the layers and have the project reveal itself.
You say Western forms, but very Texan forms. And I have to say, it's really interesting for me to hear you say that you didn't feel that you could do crafts per se, because for anyone who's looked at the body of your work, you're an extraordinary craftsman and in so many areas. There are certain metaphors that keep on recurring in your art and in the ways that people speak about your art. The idea of the virus, the Venus flytrap, and alchemy, these things all keep popping up, especially the idea of the virus. What do these metaphors indicate about your approach to art?
Well, you open your eyes and ears and your influence. I think Bob Dylan had given us that wisdom. So you open your eyes and ears and your mind, and it was Burroughs, right? Language is a virus from outer space, who also articulated something very powerful about how ideas are transmitted in our world. The idea of a virus is it depends on the host and it depends on all these other things. But again, as a conceptualist, it's not always alchemy that may be driving it or a viral nature or a mutative strategy that creates a work. It depends on the piece. So I do think that the way I do work is in an evolutionary kind of methodology that allows me to rapidly transform or mutate as necessary. So maybe that sounds more viral-like being, you know, that you're able to adapt and refit your conceptual DNA to match a message that needs to be delivered. And, of course, the use of high craft and, again, not throwing out the retinal aspects of art practice is a method of capturing the mind when you see something. First of all, the audience is yourself. Yeah. It has to be intriguing enough to merit and withstand the critical practice that you apply to it, you know, the criticism that you apply to it.
You've mentioned now several times words like mutability, adaption, evolution, change. It seems as if this really is the key term for thinking a little bit about your artwork. I do want to go back a little bit to the idea of the virus and to infection, because a great example of what you once termed the insurgent mechanics of infection was the work that you did in conjunction with a consortium of artists called Gala, many of whom I think were your students from University of Georgia and from Cal Arts. And the goal was to infect the sets of the popular 1990s melodrama Melrose Place. And I think when they were exhibited, you called the exhibition In the Name of the Place. Can you talk about that project a little bit specifically in terms of the role of infection, mutability, evolution, change?
I think that was back in the early 90s. I was invited to participate in an exhibition in Los Angeles at the Museum of Contemporary Arts. And the show had to be about Los Angeles. That was the ground rules. I was also a scholar in residence at CalArts, as well as the Dodge Chair at the University of Georgia in Athens. I was flying back and forth, and for months and months, we were developing what, you know, every artist was given a task to be in this big exhibit that is more about Los Angeles and questioning what the museum could do within that role. And even then, the ideas were evolving, but I remember flying back to Georgia and looking out the window and listening to the rules of the game is that it had to be about Los Angeles. And then I was looking out the window and I said, well, Los Angeles is in the air. It is through microwave transmissions that are floating through us and in our homes every day, every moment. Previous to that, I had given a talk at the Dia Art Center in New York City in 93. It was at the EcoTech Conference in Manhattan. It was a group of mostly theoretical architects, theoreticians, people involved in the social sciences, talking about culture and evolution as well as ecology. We had worked in Corsica as well as in New York. And it was more like thoughts that we might have on this. During that time, I pulled a rifle onto the audience when it was my time to come on. I was somewhat disguised as an agent, like a Secret Service agent. Wired up. But I have taped a full Remington 700 sniper rifle, not loaded, of course, a prop piece, equipped with a Raytheon night vision scope. It was taped on the table. I told no one that this was going to happen. And I pulled it out. It was my turn. And I pointed above the audience, but everybody was dead silent, moving around in their seats, waving one side to the left. As I began to speak in the voice of a sniper that I had been studying, this idea, he had been talking to me about his kills as a covert operative working under Ronald Reagan, his targets and his methodology. I spoke in his mind, the way he would be thinking about his extraction. It was a short piece. That finished, I took out another drill gun and everybody got upset again. Yeah, but I undid the Raytheon night vision scope. And inside it, I had buried a microphone. I clicked it on, and I began to speak in a voice of a HIV virion cruising through the human body. And then the talk began, called I See the Insurgent Mechanics of Infection. It was basically a very cryptic and cloaked kind of passage or essay. And what I was addressing is that our world is transformed radically in a most devastating way by political, military, and business interests, mostly covert, without our knowledge. And we see these horrible things that can happen that serve the interests of a few and the power of a few. And I was thinking, as an artist, as we talk about what we do and how we do it, we wear our hearts on our sleeves and we go there because we're supposed to be transparent. And yet, how can you respond to this reality in the world when you open up this quest to practice things in the world and do good in the world, so to speak, yet still be critiqued by it? So I was advancing that perhaps there's a moment where we can look at the most hideous things in our culture, people that assassinate people without any remorse for political expediency, and a horrible thing that had affected many friends in the art world and families in New York, and then the whole world still, the HIV or the AIDS epidemic at the time, the tremendous loss. Looking at these things that end life, that kill us off, what if we looked at them as a model of efficiency? that a virus acts efficiently for its own interests, an assassin does the same. But recalibrate it in service to an idea, into a conversation, into a dialectic that could be promoted. It could have another life. It also would mean that you would have to be covert, because your notoriety and your whole relationship as the art world as you've known it, you'd have to be an operative and work within it quietly in a covert way.
It's clear that what you're doing is suggesting that the artist is a kind of sniper, and artwork can work covertly in this kind of way to disrupt institutions of power, the military industrial complex, business, the industrial complex more broadly. If you're just tuning in, I'm Jonathan Judaikin, and you're listening to Counterpoint. I'm speaking with conceptual artist Mel Chin, who'll give the keynote lecture at Rhodes College's upcoming symposium, Memphis Art and Place, on February 18th and 19th. Now, Mel, I know you're a fan of the French poet Mallarmé, and I understand one of your favorite quotes from Mallarmé was something he said about objects, which was that objects should be, and I'm quoting Mallarmé here, gradually evoked by means of a series of decodings. I want to ask you about a number of the objects that you've made, but rather than asking you to decode them, will you tell us a little bit about how they were encoded? So I'm asking you to tell the stories behind how you built these objects. Can we start with Revival Field, since this is your most famous work? Can you describe for listeners what that project did?
Basically, Revival Field was a replicated field test that was done for 3 years at the Pig's Eye Landfill in Minneapolis, or in St. Paul, Minnesota, that confirmed the capacity of plants called hyperaccumulators to pull heavy metals out of soil. In other words, plants that could clean the soil, and it proved it for the scientists. So that's basically Revival Field. It was a garden, small garden, that was there planted with different kind of species, and to receive data from them after we would harvest, we'd send them to the laboratory at the USDA of Dr. Rufus Cheney's lab, one of the world's experts on plant science.
And then the plants apparently were burned afterwards and the result could be used. But I guess some listeners might wonder a little bit about how a planted garden ought to be thought of as a work of art. Can you say something about that?
How that project emerged was after my first exhibition at the Hirshhorn Museum in Washington, D.C. I heard voices in my head that asked me what I loved doing most, and it was making these objects and things that so accurately described by Mallarmé. And then the other voice said, stop. So I did. I felt there was something about a challenge to me that was needed to be provoked. Probably my internal mind understood that had to happen. And so I roamed around until I found some articles, one article by a psilocybin expert, Terence McKenna, that mentioned the possibility of Datura doing this toxic cleanup. However, what drives a piece like this is not just the poetic concept, but the pragmatism that it also needs. Because once you go into the social realm, you're involving other human beings that perhaps you got to make sure it would work first. So how to describe this as a work of art is you could have the sculptor carving David, like Michelangelo, with his chisel, carving away till he creates something as amazing as his pieces, right? And so if you can think of a scientific tool as a plant to carve away toxins from the soil so that you have a renewed ecology afterward, then maybe I consider that as an aesthetic event. So you can imagine how I was thinking about even the definition of beauty. You have an object that we like, but we also have a landscape that would be dead to the world and even toxic to the world unless something was done to it. So that's how I would frame that piece, Revival Field. But then again, if the science wasn't there, then it's all conjecture. And I'm being a reality therapist. I decided to go into the field and find out that no one at that time in the world was really conducting field experiments to prove it beyond the laboratory. So Revival Field became a cooperation with Dr. Cheney in order to launch one of the first replicated field tests in the world.
I mean, that's just an extraordinary story on two levels. First of all, it's extraordinary for the ways in which you're rethinking the very role of art and where art can play a role. But just that little moment in there where you told us about this exhibition at the Hirshhorn, one of the most prestigious institutions of art in the country, and you having this moment where you say, I have to evolve beyond just simply being a sculptural artist. I've got to make other kinds of objects. It's amazing. Lead poisoning now is back in the news as a result of what's happened in Flint, Michigan. Will you tell us about your work, Operation Pay Dirt, which was a response to lead poisoning in the context of Hurricane Katrina, and also the $100 bill project that you paired with it?
Those projects are still going, and we are making our way to Flint as we're talking. You know, we're negotiating how to bring it. Because that project began in post-Katrina New Orleans. I was stunned, first of all, by the magnitude of what had happened to the people. It was not just the physical. I was not so much involved with seeing how I could rebuild. But I was interviewing at the time, just trying to see how I, as an artist, could help. I went as a citizen, basically, to see what I could do. And I was stunned by the interviews and how much psychological and social damage had been occurred to that city by the failure of not just politics, but of systems that are all human-made. It was one of the first times that I felt that I had witnessed something of such magnitude that I was left without a single idea of what to do. I felt inadequate to the tasks. So I kept going back to research more and more. Sometimes through research, you find out what you need to do. And I came upon Dr. Howard Mielke, who I'd known through Revival Field 20 years before. And he has been studying the soils in New Orleans for 20-something years. And he showed me a map. I call it the Red Lead Map. And that map, this is in 2006, showed concentrations of lead pre-Katrina. Apparently, this was there before the storm. And even more compelling and more painful was understanding that those concentrations relate to 30 to 50% of the inner city childhood population poisoned with lead before the storm. The storm had nothing to do with it. And the fact that there was very little funding going to support and to ameliorate, to undo or help to address this burden within that inner city population. And that's where Operation Pay Dirt and the $100 bill project was born. It was basically saying, if there's no money, then we'll have to make the money. And we'll have to make the money in this way, because there's no currency floating around in the cities, inner city of New Orleans, or any inner city of Flint or Cleveland or Cincinnati, or even parts of Los Angeles or Houston or Omaha to support them. Then we'll just have to draw our own. That this project's not my project, but a project of the people who can draw their own form of a $100 bill, and how we can bring it to the people most affected, which would be the children themselves, so they can draw their form of cash and also teach them how to be protected better in the process. So in other words, the value of this currency would be the hopes and dreams and imagination that is being compromised by a heavy metal neurotoxin. And how do we do this? So that's how that project was started. We have 450,000 hand-drawn individual bills. We are holding them. We're holding them till the right moment and the right time to turn them in. Already, and by the way, things have changed. It's not just about stopping lead in New Orleans. We went 20,000 miles in an armored truck to pick up the original 350,000 drawings. And we did this because we understood that the problem is not about lead in soil or lead in water, as it is in Flint. The problem is lead in the blood of children and in the brains and in their future and the burden it applies in the families that result after this.
And I guess we could extend this into a metaphor to say it's also about the leaden thinking that leads to these kinds of things by refusing to deal systemically with some of the kinds of issues that you point to. If you'll permit me, I want to transition to another work of yours. You mentioned this infamous lecture that you gave at the Ecotech conference in New York, which talked about one gun. I want to ask you about another piece of yours, another gun, your piece, Homie Soul 9. Which I understand was a response to things like Dr. Dre and Snoop Dogg and others rapping about Glock 9s in the hood. What was the story behind Homie Soul 9?
Homicidal Nine was for the Black Male exhibition in 1994 at the Whitney Museum of Art. I was included in it. I thought it was Black M-E-L, but I guess not. It was M-A-L-E. So I was fooled into being part of that. Anyway, I felt like I wasn't adequate to make a commentary on being a black male, but I felt I could develop an accessory to that. And the idea of the Glock is not just what Snoop or Malik had rapped about. I'm strapped in your block with my Glock, ready to let loose in any imitator that I spot. It was actually looking at this whole history of a military sidearm of the NATO police that was being promoted at such an alarming rate throughout America, coming straight out of Smyrna, Georgia, and Austria firearm sales, right? And how that was in the hands of one of the first mass killings in Texas at a cafeteria when it had first occurred, when the first weapon was first used, and how this powerful weapon would also unleash, 47 bullets into a man in New York City as he pulls his wallet out. He happened to be black. And all these things contributed to looking at this weapon, and also the idea of the aura of a gun is so powerful in our country. The aura is so strong, as Walter Benjamin would point out. I felt like there's very little I could do to make it art. So instead, what Homicidal Nine is I took these weapons and went to a machine shop and cored out every part of its working component and retrofitted the insides with a complete gunshot trauma kit, with angiocatheters for pneumotension thorax, to epinephrine for your blood pressure drop, to a wireless transmitter to call for help. The more you deconstructed this object, the closer you get to saving your life or someone else. So that's what Homicidal Nine's all about.
It's such a powerful piece, transforming that weapon, but also the image of that gun. After 9/11, you made a graphic art film titled 9/11/9/11. It's available on YouTube. We'll provide a link to it on our website. And in 9/11/9/11, you set side by side two 9/11 stories: the role of the United States in overthrowing the socialist Salvador Allende in Chile on September 11, 1973, with the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon by Al-Qaeda in 2001. You set about making the film, "I want us to resist an obsessive preoccupation with our American tragedy when so many other historic tragedies are also connected." Then it becomes a dialogue rather than a monologue. Was 9/11/9/11 your own kind of monument to 9/11?
After 9/11, I was asked to participate in an exhibition, Rethinking the World Trade Center Monument or Skyscraper, and I said neither monument or skyscraper. I thought that basically our obligations was to rethink our relationship with the world. But that was an opportune time to have such a horrible tragedy fall upon us. Yet our relationship with the world is also what we had accomplished in Chile in 1973. I'm not saying those events were together, happened or related. I do think that it's important to decenter our preoccupations with tragedy that enforce a very nationalistic or fascist approach as a response. It's just my personal opinion as a thinker. So we have to worry about things that are transformist in the most negative ways.
I mean, for me, what you did there was to illustrate this idea that the philosopher Derrida said about 9/11, which was that it was an autoimmune syndrome. And in a way, this returns us again to the questions about virus. Mel, the Memphis Art and Place Conference is all about art and social change in places like Memphis. And your work, from Western Dynasty Urns when you were in college through Revival Field and now post 9/11, is centrally about art and place. But if you would permit me to say so, I would say your work seems at least as much about specific places, like this place, as it does about being displaced. Would you comment on that by way of a conclusion?
I think the place that I may be interested in is a self-critical place that is hard to come by. I'm still wrestling with each delusion that comes to me, to think that maybe I've accomplished things and that's good enough. So it's not about other places. It is being an artist, sometimes it can be a very introspective kind of affair. And I think that we speak of how the unexamined life, we quote the great philosophers, how they examine life is not worth living. Sometimes our very relationship to the world removes those tools of examination. So maybe my obligation or my job description is to create those tools, if not for myself, for others.
Well, that's a wonderful way of putting it. And we're really looking forward to continuing the conversation at your public lecture at Rhodes College on February 18th at 6 p.m. Stuck Inside of Mobile with the Memphis Blues Again, Our Place in the Age of a Dystopian Future. Mel Chin, thank you so much for being with us today on Counterpoint.
I appreciate you. Take care.
Putting a spotlight on the role of scholars, academics, and intellectuals, and how their work illuminates the issues we face locally and globally, Counterpoint is a monthly broadcast on WKNO FM. To listen to this show in its entirety, visit WKNOFM.org and click on the news menu item where you'll find a link to Counterpoint. You can podcast Counterpoint by visiting iTunes and searching for WKNO Counterpoint. Counterpoint is a production of WKNO FM in association with the Spence L. Wilson Chair in Humanities at Rhodes College. Justin Willingham produces the show. I'm Jonathan Judakin. Thanks for listening.